You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is The Brian Callen Show with Hunter Motz, as always. And Hunter Motz once again gets a great guest. Detlef Schlichter has been working in the financial markets for 19 years, J.P. Morgan, etc. He's written a great book here and something that we've been talking about a lot. And I'll give the exact. It's called Paper Money Collapse, The Folly of Elastic Money. And what I gathered from your book, and I want to just reiterate first, is that whenever we start talking about economics or we start using words like capital markets, most people, especially my listeners and my, you know, it's not anybody's fault, but a lot of people get intimidated by big words. And most of us are not steeped in economic theory, et cetera. So what I want to do is try to make this, and one of the things I really enjoyed about not only your lectures, but your book, is you make it very accessible to a layman like myself. And really, we all know, if you talk to most people, even though they don't know much about economics, we all know that there's something wrong. We all know something went wrong. And I'm speaking specifically of 2007. And most of us know that most of it probably wasn't fixed. What I very much appreciate about your argument is that you are an admirer of F.A. Hayek. You are you believe in free markets, capital markets. That always seems to make sense to me. I live in that world. I'm a stand-up comic. If I don't make you laugh, you don't pay for tickets. You know, if I don't make you laugh, you don't come back to my next show. I mean, it's pretty cutthroat. I've always said show business in many ways is actually fair because there's no second place. You're either the best guy in the room or you're not. And I think the banking industry has been so heavily regulated for so long. And it is your argument that money, as it stands now, it's a very unique commodity, first of all, but in terms of it's a transactional issue. It's really based on transactional value. So nobody inherently wants 1,000 pieces of paper, but it correlates to what that can buy, the kind of goods and services it can buy. But your argument essentially is that, look, money is not, it's soft money. It is not attached to anything hard. It is political. It is always moving. And money needs to be attached to something immovable. I mean, to an extent. It's not that you're necessarily advocating for the gold standard in the strict sense of the word. But I want to explain kind of, I want to get to, in layman's terms, what you think is wrong with the current financial system. Because your book and your thesis is in many ways very much at odds with the general financial consensus. If you look at, if you talk to most bankers, and I have, if you talk to, you know, if you look at what the media says, you're kind of at odds with a lot of what they say. Because as far as they're concerned, look, there's nothing wrong with printing money. There's nothing wrong with having a central authority control the money supply, control interest rates. And you have a different point of view. That was a long introduction. Sorry. We'll edit that down.
No, thanks, Brian. And it was a very good introduction because I think that is exactly what I was trying to do with the book. I think, first of all, thanks very much for saying it's accessible. That's what I was trying to do. There is no need for anybody to be intimidated by economics. I think we all use money every day, so we all are money users. And my book starts from the very basics, the first principles of money, you know, that I think that we can all relate to. We all use money. We know why we use money. And I think from there, you can derive a theory of what makes good money. And yes, I think we don't have good money right now because money has, over the last 100 years, been completely politicized. It's now a tool for economic policy. And again, you mentioned I approach this from a free market point of view, which is correct. And I think most people think that the capital markets we have today and banking and finance is almost the sort of the epitome of free market capitalism. That is the free market, but it is really not. And I think I worked in finance for almost 20 years, and the reason I left the industry and wanted to write this book is exactly because I felt that both what economists speak about and what they say makes good money and how we should have the monetary system, and how most people think about it or read about it in the newspapers, I think is wrong. Money is the monetary system is not a free market system. It's highly politicized, as I said, and money has become a tool for monetary policy.
So let me stop. Let me stop you there very quickly and just explain to some of our listeners what you mean specifically by a free market. Because I think that I really think that term gets thrown around a lot, but I don't think people dilate enough on it. Let's talk a little bit about what you mean by a free market in terms of money.
In a way, what you said is, if you don't make any money unless you get people to come to your show and pay to see you, and I don't make any money unless people find my book interesting and buy my book. So the first thing, your free market is just a process by which people come together and cooperate economically. And in a free market, ultimately, only the person or those people can make money would do something that the buying public is willingly spending money on. So a free market, first of all, means complete consumer power. So the first thing, most people today think the free market is a rigged system, it's just for the bankers and so forth. I think that's the political aspect of the monetary system. A proper free market simply means you buy what you want to buy and you don't buy what you do not want to buy. That creates profit or loss on a company level. And via buying or not buying, and via profit and loss, ultimately in a proper free market, those things get produced that the consumers want. So I think the free market is consumer power at the end of the day.
And let me say this to the listeners: what I really appreciated was essentially you're saying that the government and in fact even bankers should be, in many ways, removed from the money process. I mean, removed from the relationship, the transactional relationship that happens. You're trying to put money back into the power of people, consumers, the local economies. It's not to say that bankers shouldn't be involved in money, because you can put a value on money. You can speculate on whether or not a company is worth as much. Somebody has a different idea of this company is worth this much, this company is worth this much. It's not to say that banks shouldn't be involved. But for the most part, you're saying government and even government should be kind of taken out of the equation to a large extent, right?
Absolutely. And I think what happened in the field of money is if you look back in history, obviously we all need money. I mean, money is needed in a market economy as a medium of exchange. And if you look throughout history, the trading public has always chosen certain things to be money, to be the monetary asset. And through most of history and in most cultures and most societies, they ultimately chose the precious metals, mainly gold and silver. And you mentioned the gold standard, and that has probably been the most advanced monetary systems we had. And you imagine the gold standard, when money at its core is gold. Obviously, banks have always been in the business of issuing, I would call that money derivatives, on top of the gold supply. So it wasn't just strictly gold, but at the core, it was gold or silver. And that meant money was, the supply of money at its core level was outside of anybody's control. I mean, there was no government that could just simply...
Because there was a fixed value, and that fixed value was, depending on how much gold was actually in a safe, essentially, I mean, there was a fixed value, and it was fixed to gold.
And it was not only
exactly.
that there
and,
was...
And And as I said, the banks, over the last sort of 300 years since we had banks have always been in the business of issuing banknotes and more recently bank deposits, which also function as money in our economy. So even if we had a gold standard, or even at times when we did have a gold standard, what people used as money was a bit broader than just gold. But because at the end you could go back to your bank and demand that they exchange the banknotes or the bank deposits for gold, there was a strict limit in practice, in place for the banks, and that limited the overall supply of money. And what I argue in my book is you can show that on the basic of theory or conceptually, and as I said, I hope in a way that also the layperson can understand, is that gives the financial system a certain anchor. It sounds a bit like a financial straitjacket, but it's actually one that keeps the system stable. Now, what happened over the last 100 years, in a very slow process, actually, is that we moved away from any kind of checks and balances on the monetary system. We demonetized gold and moved away from gold to a complete fiat money system.
What is a fiat money system? What do you mean by that?
Well, fiat is the word fiat for there's a Latin word for let it be.
Right.
It shall be.
Right.
So it's basically money where the state says this is money, and so therefore it's the today we live in a system where nowhere in the world is the supply of money confined or restricted by any kind of commodity or by any apolitical, you know, fixed entity, but is entirely at the discretion of our monetary politicians or central bankers. And so we are now in the age of, you know, money printing and central bankers. I think it's very important to realize that that is a fairly recent phenomenon. I mean, in the United States, domestically, the gold standard was abandoned during the Great Depression in 1933. But after the Second World War, it was still maintained internationally. And I think few people realize that there was a link between the US dollar and gold, at least in international financial markets, that was maintained until August 1971. And that constrained or restrained the ability of the US government and any other government, you know, because the dollar was the reserve currency globally, it constrained the ability of any government and any banking system to create, you know, money. This constraint has finally been removed in August 1971 when Richard Nixon closed the gold window, and it's only been for 43 years now.
Why did he close the gold window? Why did we go away from the gold standard?
Because in history, it's always been the same story, and so it was in 1971 because the government needed more money. It started in the 1960s. There was obviously the U.S. government, as all democratic governments in the second half of the 20th century, started to take on extra responsibilities.
So the government, in other words, the government got too big. It grew too big.
Welfare state, and then obviously the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War was a catalyst. And it's interesting, in history, most paper money systems or fiat money systems, you know, state money systems, came about during times of war, because these used to be the times when governments needed most money, and they abandoned the gold anchor. I mean, the United States were off a gold standard during the Civil War and printed more money to fund the war effort, and then went back onto a gold standard in 1879. The British government was on gold through most of, you know, the British pound's history, but occasionally took the pound off gold or occasionally off silver to fund wars.
That's interesting.
What has really changed in the 20th century is that on the one hand, we had the wars, which, you know, the classical gold standard that I mentioned earlier, the major period of an international gold standard, lasted from 1879 to 1914. And obviously 1914, 100 years ago, because Germany was the first country to leave it, to fund the First World War. But after the Second World War, there was a discussion of what kind of monetary system the world should go back to, and a strict gold standard was not chosen. Instead, it was some kind of hybrid system called Bretton Woods system. But even that system supplied a link to gold. And I think, so it's not, for a very long time, until very recently, you know, most politicians, central bankers, economists would have argued that the financial system needs some kind of stable anchor. That has been removed in 1971. And I think what my book argues in particular, it's a challenge, I hope, for the mainstream consensus of economists, will now argue that this system of what I would call elastic money, you know, where money is no longer restricted, it's elastic, it's now a political tool. And if central bankers handle this, you know, in a smart way and astutely and accurately, then we can have a more stable economy. And what my book shows, and I think what experience is beginning to tell us, is that that is not the case, that it's actually an unstable system.
We recently had Ben Dyson on, as you know, of Positive Money. And, you know, Ben's argument is basically that, you know, currently bankers have this ability to create virtually limitless amounts of money through fractional reserve banking. And he wants to transfer that power to the government. What I really, really appreciated about your book is that you're saying that the government is no more trustworthy. And that the benefit of the gold standard is that it takes it out of the hands of business and out of the hands of government. And I never really understood the gold standard or the argument until I read your book. And the benefit is not just that there's a limited amount of gold within an individual bank's vaults, but there's a limited amount of gold in the world. Essentially, the amount of money that can exist is relatively fixed. And, you know, you can't, you know, short of a change in the laws of nature, you can't just, like, expand that money supply at will.
Absolutely correct. And I think that's the key point. So that's why, you know, we people who defend the gold standard, or, you know, would even consider going back to some form of gold standard, often that sounds very atavistic, because it's like, because we like shiny things.
So you're actually thinking, when I hear you say the gold standard, you know, there are two things that pop into my mind. One is actually taking bars of gold and putting them into a safe, and then putting them on a ship and bringing them back to this other, you know, and moving that gold back and forth just so you have physical gold doesn't seem very practical. The other issue is that gold feels like very much like paper currency. There's nothing inherently, you know, valuable about gold. I suppose you could put it in your teeth or use it in some machinery, but for the most part, it is it still is rather unique as a commodity in terms of the fact it is a transactional. It has a transactional value that's put upon it based on, you know, I guess what I mean. Even though wars have been fought, I mean, somehow human beings have a. It's a very weird thing, but I've been to vaults where you see nothing but stacks of gold. Your eye does fall. It's hard to turn your gaze away from gold. There's something really quite beautiful and sort of, I think human beings must be drawn to that shiny, you know, crazy thing that never decomposes, that stays just as shiny for 1,000 years, you know. But I wonder if you're going to have the same issue with gold and paper money. You're still putting a value on it, right? It's not like a horse that I can get some value out of.
But the difference is you can print money all day long. You can't print gold all day long.
It's hard to mine. You're right. Yeah. It's expensive to mine. That's one of the things you talk about. It's expensive to mine. It's a laborious process. That makes sense.
I think any form of money is in a way a social convention.
Yes.
You know, something is money, and because other people accept it as money.
Yeah.
And the value that money has, the purchasing power that money has, is always it always obtains through the trading public. I mean, you see this in countries where there are many countries that have a government and a central bank, and still money becomes worthless, like Zimbabwe.
And by the way, I mean, I think that your point is to be taken. We don't have to dial it on gold. I mean, the point is that you're saying it needs to be anchored with something more solid. There's got to be a foundation that our money is anchored to. It's got to be apolitical. And that seems to make all the sense in the world to me. The only thing is, the other question I would have is, I wonder, though, what that says about the creative financial tools that have come about in the past 30 years or so. And I remember, keep in mind, I'm not a banker, but aren't derivatives and credit default swaps, aren't these things sort of, isn't this sort of how you, you leverage money? I mean, what is that? How would one leverage money and lend money based on what you think a company is worth? I mean, some people think this company is going to be worth $1 million tomorrow. Other people think it's going to be worth nothing. There's money to be made. You can bet on the value of that money, and you can sell credit and options and things based on that, or swaps, whatever it is. Derivatives are creative financial tools that I've heard. People have told me that they're one of the reasons that it's so easy to get a loan and why there is more money available for people who wouldn't have it otherwise. What does that say about that? Wouldn't going back to the gold standard, and you've addressed this a little bit, but let's talk a little more about it. Wouldn't going back to the gold standard maybe stifle creativity in the financial markets? And is that a bad thing?
I don't think it would stifle creativity. I think many of the things we have seen develop over the last 30-odd years probably make sense. And even in a proper free monetary system, free market monetary system, based on a hard commodity, whether it's gold, silver, or maybe even Bitcoin, you would get financial innovation, because that's innovation, payment technology, you know, credit cards, internet payments, or, as you said, derivatives. Please remember, even in a hard monetary system based on gold, you would have borrowing and lending. I could save in gold and then lend my gold to you to invest in a business. So, you know, I think the one key difference is that over the last 40 years, we had a massive, unprecedented expansion of money, fiat money, printed money, globally. It's literally off the charts. There's nothing historically that is comparable to it. Even gold discoveries in the 16th century in Latin America, that were massive monetary inflow in Spain at the time, they look minuscule compared to the kind of money we've created over the last 40 years. And therefore, I would say a lot of what we see in financial markets, for example, you know, sort of overstretched equity markets and massive derivative markets, I think we would get bull and bear markets. We would get derivatives in a hard money system. We wouldn't get them to the same extent. And I think the key problem is now that all the credit expansion that has occurred and all the things that, for example, Ben Dyson is complaining about, that the banks have created all this money and therefore levered their balance sheets and created these housing booms and so forth, that is built into the system, because we now have central banks that watch the banks' back, and when the banks lower their when the banks lend less money, when they become more conservative, when they are concerned about what they're risk-taking, and when they scale back, the central bank comes out and provides new reserves to them, lowers interest rates. That was one of the things that got me to write the book. In my 20 years in the business, I've been through quite a few of these cycles, and every few years we get into a crisis that is worse than the one before, and the policy response is always the same. We just keep the rates even lower, print even more, you know, money reserves, bank reserves for the banks to keep on going. And I think now we reach this point where around the world, all central banks are now at practically zero interest rates, from Japan through Europe through the UK through the US, the US Federal Reserve. We have globally zero interest rates from all central banks around the world, and all these central banks have bought massive amounts of financial assets over the last 5 years to bail out the financial system. That tells you that that system is inherently unstable.
It sounds like they're just giving money away, essentially.
And I mean, the reason why they're at zero interest rates is because there's zero risk for these banks, because they know the government will bail them out if they fail, essentially, right?
Exactly. And this is why, I think you see one of my problems I have with Positive Money, and Ben over here in the UK is that sort of they're a little bit too much, in my view, on that sort of anti-banking bandwagon. I don't want to excuse the bankers. The bankers, in the run-up to the crisis, they've done stupid things. And yes, some of them were stupid, some of them were greedy. But banking could be a much more honorable business if it was operating within the same confines that other businesses work in.
A free market system. I mean,
free market.
Yeah.
Yeah. Other businesses don't have a lender of last resort. I mean, we have this absurd construct. And what drives me crazy is that many economists today justify this as giving us stability, that banks have a lender of last resort, that if they are in trouble, they have the central bank to watch their back. That is a setup that must encourage reckless lending, that must encourage low observance of risk of lending standards.
That's saying that a trust fund kid is going to make great decisions because no matter what happens, daddy will bail him out.
Yeah, that's right. Paul Krugman, who I'm not a big fan of, I think he's the most arrogant guy on the planet. But, you know, I know he won a Nobel Prize in economics from that very unbiased group in Sweden called the Nobel Committee, but they tend to be pretty left wing.
Actually, the Nobel Prize in economics is given out in Oslo, Norway.
Oh, it's in Norway. I'm sorry. But isn't it?
No, it's an adjunct. So the Karolinska Institute gives out the in inverted commas real science Nobel Prizes, and then there's some sort of adjunct body that gives out the Nobel Prize in economics, which is based in Oslo.
Oh, well, I don't stop correcting me. Sweden, Norway, anyway. But the point is, it's one of those northern where they're blonde up there. And,
yeah.
But he was, and if I remember correctly, he was really calling for a great deal of stimulus. So my guess is you disagree with Mr. Krugman.
Oh, very much so. I mean, I'm very, very much influenced by Friedrich August von Hayek and Ludwig von Mises, sort of the great Austrian school economists. And I'm very much a free market guy. Paul Krugman is not a free market guy. It's kind of strange because I think he has changed a lot. He's a Keynesian, so he's always been more in favor of government interference in the economy. Having said this, when he won the Nobel in the 1990s, there was a time when he was known as a free market Keynesian or free trade Keynesian. He was in favor of certain government interventions, but he was for free international trade. I think that has all changed because it's becoming more and more of an interventionist and a big government guy. Now, he wants more stimulus, and I think that's wrong. I do disagree with him. I think it's interesting that sort of the crisis we are in, the big major crisis of 2007 and 2008, was clearly the result of the stimulus that was put in place to fight the preceding crisis. You know, we remember there was a big credit crisis in 2002 when WorldCom went bankrupt and Enron in the U.S., at the time, the two largest corporate bankruptcies in U.S. history. And then there was a fairly shallow recession in 2001, just about the time of the 9/11 attacks. But at the time, there was a massive stimulus put in place. The Federal Reserve put interest rates down to 1%. And that, you know, added oil to the fire in the mortgage market. And the mortgage market, the housing market, was already on fire. And that accelerated it. And the dislocations that ultimately brought the system down in 2007, 2008 were clearly exacerbated, if not created, by that massive monetary stimulus we put in place in 2002. And Paul Krugman in 2001 and 2002 encouraged that stimulus. He was quite happy to see money pumped into the housing market to stimulate the economy, according to his Keynesian script. So I think we're just repeating the same thing. It's a never-ending cycle that gets ever worse.
Well, that's what worries me. And I wonder if you're... I always feel like guys like Paul Krugman, I don't know his background. I'm not sure he's ever had a real job, but that's a whole different story. I think that's significant. I think if you have to wake up, but I don't want to bash Paul Krugman. I don't care about him that much.
But
let me ask you one question. Is your argument, do you find that your argument, I mean, you wrote the book, it came out, I think, in 2011. Is your argument gaining ground, or are you constantly having to defend yourself?
Well, that's a very good question. Difficult to say because I mean, I had a lot of positive feedback. I'm very happy with the way the book was received, and now we're bringing out the second edition, which is going to come out in July. So I think in its market, the book has done reasonably well, and I've been invited to give lectures and speeches. So I'm very happy with how it was received. My concern is a little bit, or that obviously a lot of the people who embrace the book are maybe people who already were close to my kind of thinking. I did not try to preach to the converted. As I said, I'm an Austrian school economist, and there is obviously a growing community out there of Austrians, and I think many like the book. But I really tried to write the book for mainstream economists, you know, the people who read more Paul Krugman than Hayek, and also for let's say the educated populace, you know, people who are interested in economics without being economists, and again, I had good feedback, great feedback from students of economics who felt that I was addressing some of the issues that they find interesting and that not been heard addressed in class. So I'm very encouraged but at the same time, I think it's still an uphill struggle.
Has Krugman read your book? The only reason I bring him up is he's got a big readership, you know, among, you know, the intelligentsia, the New York Times, the New York Times intelligentsia, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you can taste my disdain, the disdain in my voice. But whenever I speak with Paul Krugman, I find myself speaking the Queen's English. He seems like such an elitist. But anyway,
that's the interesting thing as well. You've mentioned, you know, the Keynesians, and also in the book you talk a lot about the monetarists, and those are really the two dominant schools currently in economic thinking. And then the third school is really the Austrian school of economics, right?
That's correct, yes.
Right. Would you mind breaking down for us just what are the differences between that? Because so much of it is that there are basically these three religious worldviews that exist in economics. And, you know, the Keynesians, when things aren't going right, just say they need to be more Keynesian. And, you know, the monetarists, when things aren't going right, say they need to be more monetarist. And how do we sort past basically all of those ideologies to figure out? I mean, that's the thing. In reading your book, you know, it just makes a lot of very practical sense.
Good question from Hunter Moss. Now you wonder why. He's actually the smart one who doesn't talk as much. Keep going.
But Brian's the handsome one. Yeah. And in the end, it's better to be pretty than smart.
With a very hypnotic voice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go on.
Well, I'll try to distinguish the three main schools. I mean, before I do that, I have to say that, I mean, I think what some of the things that concern me is that obviously you can have these different camps now, and the Austrians just read the Austrian text, and the Keynesians just read the Keynesian text, and they don't speak. They're like three different churches, and they don't speak to one another anymore. And again, there was something that I was trying to break down with the book. It was not written. I didn't advertise that it was written from an Austrian perspective, and I don't start with writing, this is what Mises said, and this was what Hayek said. I go back to first principles and try to develop a convincing argument that, whether you're Keynesian or not, you go along my argument. Either you can show me where I'm wrong, or you have to admit, you know, that there's a point.
I think you do that in the book and in your arguments and your lectures very, very well. Very well. But keep going.
I hope so. But I mean, just to distinguish the three schools, I mean, I would say that the Austrian school is much more in line, I think, with the way economics overall has developed over the last 300 years. So I don't think the Austrian thinkers like Hayek or Mises would argue that they stand outside the tradition of economics. So I think one of the key features in the Austrian school is simply that since the late 19th century, there was a new movement in economics, was called the marginalist revolution, where basically people realized that economic processes are best understood by going back to the individuals who are making the decisions. And because then you can understand how people prefer one thing to another thing, how that explains relative prices and costs, and as I explained
before, timing as well, like when they choose to buy something. Yeah,
exactly. You know, the impact of time preference. So by starting from the individual actor, there was a change in economics in the 20th century then, specifically after Keynesianism became to dominate, I mean, named after John Maynard Keynes, the great British economist. And I think the focus has now been much more on statistical variables, on statistical aggregates. So we don't look anymore at individual actors. We look at aggregates like GDP or all the consumers.
Graphs, macro perspective on everything, right? So kind of like
exactly.
Statistics.
And most economic discussions today, whether in the New York Times or on TV, tend to be macro discussions. And they're driven by statistical entities. And I think the problem is simply, if you look at something like money, you know, if you say, well, you should be print more money or less money, the argument quickly is one about, oh, we need more growth, so we need to print more money and lower interest rates. And then the problem is that may create inflation. Now, these are all macro variables, GDP, inflation. These are all statistical aggregates. But the problem, as the Austrians showed and as previous generations of economists also knew, the problem with money is not just on the price level, on the overall purchasing power of money or on GDP. It's on relative prices. By pushing money into the economy, you can make certain things more expensive versus others, like real estate versus other things. And that can create these dislocations, these deformations in your economy, which you cannot capture by GDP or the price level. They're way too rough measures of what goes on in the economy.
Well, you bring up a really important point, too, that I thought was interesting, was when you stimulate an economy with money, when you put more money in an economy, some people get that money faster than other people.
Oh, exactly.
You know,
you create winners and losers. You change the economy. Well, I think most people think if you lower interest rate and print more money, it's just everybody benefits from this. That's not true,
no.
And it cannot be true. And you can show that it will never be true, because by these forms of intervention, the central bank has changed the economy. Certain things will be done much more than others. Certain people get the money first. The people who get the money first were usually people who work in the financial industry or in real estate. They can spend the money before it has really inflated and more prices have gone up. So they are always the first beneficiaries or the main beneficiaries of any kind of infusion of new money. Interestingly, that is something that, you know, French economist Richard Cantillon described 300 years ago and has been a big topic of the investigations of the British classical economists in the 19th century. So this isn't even a very new discovery, but in a world where we always talk about inflation and GDP, people keep forgetting this. And as long as we don't have much inflation, people think we can just print more money and lower interest rates and everybody is happy. That is a mistake. And we're creating more misallocations of capital, deformations in the economy, excess debt, mispriced assets. And that is what will cause economic problems, not GDP or inflation.
The interesting thing is, too, is that one of the criticisms that's usually made of the Austrian School of Economics is that it's not mathematical enough. There aren't enough statistics. There isn't enough respect for those models and all that sort of stuff. And I think in the wake of 2008, that's a really interesting argument, because the whole point of 2008 was that they tried to turn economics into physics. And, you know, they built these very complex models and they really developed the faith that, you know, if there was enough math around a problem, then it must be true. And you're even seeing within, you know, people like Thaler and Sunstein, there's a move towards realizing that, you know, ultimately economies are made up of human beings and they rest on psychology, they rest on the individual's choices and all of that sort of stuff. So it seems to me that a lot of what you're driving at is the fact that, you know, you can come up with an abstract mathematical model, but ultimately all of economics is grounded in the choices of an individual human being with the weird foibles of human psychology, and that your starting point should really be the individual.
And then I think to piggyback on that, you don't even need a central government or a government for an economy to start. If you just throw a bunch of people together, even in the slums of India or Calcutta or whatever, like, you know, those are thriving economies. It, you know, the things just, people start to develop ways of interacting with each other. I want food, you want this, I'll make this, you give me this. I mean, that's, you know, that's how we are naturally.
Absolutely. I mean, the market is nothing but a form of human cooperation, and it's a very highly developed form of human cooperation because it allows us to cooperate with people that we have never met before, that we maybe never meet again or that we never see, but we benefit from their work and they benefit from what we pay for it. So you have this fantastic thing that we created over, well, really the last 300 years, which is a global division of labor, and we can now benefit from one another and our ideas, and that is what the market is. So I think it's unfortunate that it got such a bad name all the time, as being always blamed for any crisis that comes about. I fully agree with what you said. I think this is, people participate in this massive process because they can see the benefits of it.
Right. I mean, I always go back to just remembering I had to redo the inside of my house, and I did a major renovation. I had to buy stone and marble, and I had to get paint, and I had to get rugs and flooring. One of the things that I found fascinating was that when I was, I had to go all over Los Angeles, a huge area, to get these different things. What was amazing was that when you want to go get good flooring, it's all word of mouth. It's all reputation. It's not even, you don't have to sign a contract, really. It's just a handshake. What happens is people know that if they don't do a good job and they don't help the other guy out over here, he's not going to recommend that customer to the, and it just becomes this very tight-knit, very well-oiled machine. Local economies are amazing if they're left alone. They're amazing. They work very, very well. And more importantly, good relationships and friendships develop around those economies. There becomes an organic fabric that builds up around real communities. That's what I think is so fascinating. And I also want to just say, you know, as we talk about this stuff, I'm thinking about how, you know, how important a discussion like this is. And it's such a bummer in some ways that most people aren't willing, because we're talking about, you're tackling a very important question, a very important problem that affects every single one of us.
And every single moment of every single day. I mean, it's so fundamental to, you know, whether we can fulfill our dreams, whether we can have a house, whether we
that's
can,
right.
you know, pay for good schooling for our kids.
And I happen to believe, I'm not an economist, but in my own layman's way, I happen to believe if the Paul Krugmans of the world win the war of ideas in this particular arena, and you lose, then we're going to pay an even bigger price. But I think it's important to have that debate. I don't know if I'm right, but I certainly am very taken with your argument. That's for sure in your book. So, but I just think that I find it such a privilege. This is why I think this, you know, doing these kinds of interviews are so important. It's just, you know, we have a lot of opportunity to interview actors and comedians, and you know what, man? They don't have I'm including myself in this group. We don't have a whole lot to say. We'll make you laugh and be silly, but this is just an important discussion.
Yeah.
And it takes a little time, a little kind of focus, but it's very,
yeah, but
very
once you get into it, it's fascinating.
It's simple.
Yeah.
It's simple. You're breaking down the different schools of economics, and we're talking about, ain't it the truth? This is exactly how human beings are. We break into schools. The Democrats ain't talking to the Republicans. The Republicans aren't talking to the Democrats. And that's the way it is. And our team wins. We are by nature tribal organisms. Human beings are so tribal. We're so religious when it comes to when we hook on to an idea. But what I appreciate about F.A. Hayek, what I appreciate about the Austrian School of Economics, is that it is a very human. It starts on the human level. It starts with human behavior. It starts local. It starts with looking at exactly how human beings behave and what money really means to them on a small scale, and then you can apply it. But when you start, it's just like planning a community. If you plan a community on a board and you say, well, we're going to have flow here, we got to have a highway through here, and you don't go and investigate what's already on the ground, if you don't go in there, it's like invading a country and trying to change their entire government and their way of life. You better know the culture. You better know what was going on with Iraq for 1,000 years before you come in, et cetera, et cetera. So I feel that that's kind of the value of someone like F.A. Hayek or Milton Friedman, certainly somebody who's worked in the economy, worked in the financial sector like yourself. I'm going to listen to a guy like you who's actually worked in the financial markets, had to wake up every morning and make a profit. I'm going to listen to a guy like you because I think you're dealing on a much more human level than someone like Paul Krugman or even Keynes himself, who is looking at graphs and supply and demand and how that, and so your point is very well taken there, I think. It's not to say that graphs and looking at the macro perspective isn't important, but...
Yeah, but you can be fooled by it. I mean, that's the point of Nicholas Taleb's book is, you know, you can have so much faith in your models that you have predicted that, you know, housing can never go down.
The black swan.
The black swan, yeah. Exactly. And that's the point is, you know, you're blinded by the power of your own mathematics, you know? The other thing that I really, really loved about the book, too, is that at the end, you know, a large part of the point that you make is that this doesn't, you know, fixing this doesn't necessarily require, you know, governments to change their mind or anything like that, that we're already seeing innovations in the money supply and that we'll continue to see that and that people will choose to gravitate towards money that is actually reliable rather than this elastic money.
Yeah, I think there are some encouraging developments there. Now, obviously, one is the development that I think more people have now rediscovered gold. I mean, okay, last year was a difficult year for gold, but that was after a 13-year bull market. And I do think this massive repricing of gold already tells you that some people are very uncomfortable with the kind of money printing that goes on. I think another development that I think is absolutely fascinating is the arrival of cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin. Now, I know that there...
What are those? Tell me what those are.
Well, cryptocurrencies are digital currencies, so they are just simply exist on the on computers. You know, they're basically just algorithms. And the dominant currency right now in that arena is Bitcoin, which was created in 2008 or 2009. So when it came out and was being used by a couple of people, I wasn't even aware of that when I handed in the first manuscript for my book. Now, in my second edition, there will be a chapter on Bitcoin because it's fascinating. Because Bitcoin is the first digital currency that is created in such a way that it does not need an issuing authority. So there is nobody, no entity or no group of people behind Bitcoin that prints or creates the Bitcoin. There is an algorithm, which is open source software, and then there is a computer network, a decentralized computer network, and anybody
you're,
wears
you're talking about e-commerce here, right? I mean, isn't that what you're talking about?
No, it's more than that, though.
But it's a currency that is being created by these computers being connected together. So anybody who has a computer and is willing to pay the huge energy bills and commit massive computing power can participate in this and create these currencies. But obviously, you don't have to. You can go in and buy Bitcoin now on exchanges. But here's a currency you can think of it as a bit like a... You know, it's a global currency, it's international, if people adopt it as a currency. That's a big if, of course. But you can pay somebody in another country, you can pay hundreds of millions of Bitcoin to them if you want to, and all you need is the other person to be connected to you via the internet. So in a way, it's a bit like a monetary Skype. You know, you can connect anybody in the world and pay. Now, obviously, the question right now, the Bitcoin, there are about sort of, 12, 13 million Bitcoin in existence. Right now, they have a value of about close to $600 each, which makes should we do my math, $10 billion economy or $10 billion outstanding. It's tiny. It's a speck on the monetary
landscape. I like how quickly you did that calculation.
And how quickly you said $10 billion is a speck.
Exactly.
I think the U.S. Federal Reserve just printed a trillion, you know, 1,000 billion last year alone. The U.S. money supply, M2, is about $11 trillion. So this is nothing, you know. Yeah. Bitcoin right now is nothing. But I think the idea behind it is fascinating because usually, you know, with any form of money other than gold, you know, gold has no issuing authority. Then nobody controls it. It's outside of anybody's control. That's fascinating. With Bitcoin, you have a currency, potentially a form of money, potentially if people accept it, that also has no issuing authority. It's a bit like cryptographic gold. You know, it's something that we can all create via participating in this computing process. But
so you're essentially saying that it's people on computers can decide whether or not they want to start to use Bitcoin as real currency. But what is Bitcoin? So, but one Bitcoin, basically, if you wanted to cash in your Bitcoins to buy a house, one Bitcoin represents roughly $600, in other words.
Right, but that is obviously determined by the Bitcoin community, you know, what kind of price they put on it. But
it's a new currency. We're looking at a new currency being created, basically.
Exactly. But it's a bit, I mean, it may not take off. It's been around for a few years. It's incredibly successful. It's grown tremendously. People do use it already. Someone bought a house in Hong Kong with Bitcoin. And so it is beginning to get used a bit more frequently. I look at it as an economist. I think it's just an example for what Hunter said before. It's like, you know, it's the ingenuity of people. I mean, people look at these monetary problems and they come up with solutions. And one solution is to create currencies that are apolitical, that are not dominated by a political entity. And I think it's very interesting how the response has been to something like Bitcoin, because, again, many economists say, you know, we cannot have this because we need the government to decide how much money the economy needs and what the inflation rate should be and what GDP should be, you know, all the macro variables again. We need somebody to provide in a very clever way the right amount of money for society. And I think that's the wrong approach. As I argue in my book, what we need is international money, apolitical money that nobody controls, and that's hard money. And gold would be such a form of money and has been such a form of money for 2,500 years. Potentially, Bitcoin could be a new form of money that is equally apolitical, international, and hard, and under nobody's control.
I have two follow-up questions on that. We got a question from Dave Hirsch on Twitter, a listener, and he said, Krugman blasts cryptocurrency for lack of store of value, presumably because of volatility. What's the best way around this? Liquidity? Question mark. What do you think?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think it's for any new form of money, it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation because, you know, you can only have a stable exchange value if lots of people use it as money. I mean, the more people use, if more and more people use gold as a form of money, its price would stabilize. If more and more people use Bitcoin, then its price will stabilize and become more stable. So in a way, I think Paul Krugman's criticism is not entirely wrong, but it's what he's saying is this is not yet money. It's not widely accepted. And because it's not yet widely accepted, its price is not quite stable yet. As more and more people accept it, it will get more stable. So I think it's a bit of it's obviously a challenge for Bitcoin, because if the fact that its price is not quite yet stable will deter some people from using it or keeping it.
I'm optimistic, though. I mean, the commerce and e-commerce and you know, I mean, computer technology isn't going anywhere. This ain't a fad. So
yeah, it actually about a year ago we had on James Rickards talking about Currency Wars, his book, and one of the scenarios that he talked about in there was if a government, say Russia, decided to issue a gold-backed currency. And what that would do, and you know, that would you see flight of wealth into that currency because it was actually backed by something? It was an inelastic currency. Do you think that sort of scenario is possible? That maybe some sort of country would choose to do that, and that
not,
might
not Putin because he would
well,
just take it
Putin,
all.
Well, not Putin, but you know.
Yeah, I could see that happening. I mean, I think it's probably more likely that maybe a number of countries pool their interests and create something together. I mean, mm-hmm. My friend John Butler wrote a book about this where he argues that maybe Russia, China, Brazil, South Africa, sort of the BRIC countries, the up-and-coming emerging economic countries, could, you know, together create some kind of international gold-backed currency because they do not want to be at the mercy of the major fiat currencies, in particular the US dollar. I could see some of these scenarios. I think that the problem is still that I think most governments still like the idea of controlling their money. I mean, I think that's for modern government.
I mean, every government wants to be able to print money.
And I think you see in the case of China, China has obviously in recent years completely misused that power. They created massive investments, mainly through money printing. They had a massive monetary expansion over the last, you know, 5 years that has caused extreme dislocations in the Chinese economy. We see a massive real estate bubble, a massive overinvestment, huge credit dislocations, which are quite frankly scary. I mean, the amount of outstanding corporate debt in China is massive. And the money supply is now larger, much larger than in the United States, although it's a smaller economy. So some of these countries would have to go through some difficult adjustment themselves in order to go back to gold. But yes, I would say the case in the long run for hard money is so compelling that sooner or later somebody will do it.
And it's something that's way too important to descend into, like, schools bickering. Like, this should be an apartisan issue.
Well, you say, right? I mean, you expect another catastrophe. I mean, don't you, if we don't get our act together here?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I think that's why I'm concerned, because right now central banks have painted themselves into a corner. As I said, all of these central banks are at zero interest rates, and nobody really dares hiking interest rates or removing any liquidity from the system. The banking system has been oversupplied with liquidity, 10 times over, just to make sure everything keeps standing and functioning. So I think right now central banks created a mirage of stability and solvency, and nobody wants to pull the rug from under the system. So I think the ultimately the choice is whether we bite the bullet, go back to some hard form of money, and then in the process allow the market to liquidate some of these dislocations that have accumulated. Or if we don't have the political willpower to do that, they have to keep printing money. I think, and right now, through my 20 years in the business, they've always done the same: lower interest rate, print more money, and try to inflate
yourself. The hard thing to do is to try to communicate this argument in many ways to the voting public, I would imagine, because as a politician, as a president, you almost have to be pretty flashy and eloquent and hopeful.
But I think
I'm just thinking in terms of how I would get this message across.
Well, I think that's what you do so well in the book is that what you do is that you make this a timeless principle. You know, you ground this in history, that the rules have always been that there is a fixed money supply based around these things, and then in times of crisis, governments always try and expand that monetary supply, either by moving to paper currency or in the context of, say, the Roman Empire or, England traditionally. Mm-hmm. You start shaving off little bits of those coins. You dilute down.
For war.
For war and all that sort of stuff. And, I mean, a large part of what happened in the Roman Empire was that the silver content of these coins got so diluted out that they were basically no longer silver, and people no longer trusted the currency, and so the economy collapses and there are all sorts of problems there. So, I think that's the key is that you just have to make it clear that we're not talking about something that is, fancy
radical
or anything like that. This is a timeless principle.
It's getting back to basics.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's how you move it is that we all know that there are certain things that don't change because they're grounded in human nature. And you can hand me a piece of paper, but if I think that piece of paper is worthless, I'm not going to take it.
Money should correspond to the goods and services it can buy. I mean, the value, it should somehow, the transactional value should reflect what people are willing to give up for something else, right?
Right.
I mean, that's kind of...
By making it gold or silver or whatever it is, you're taking it out of the hands of the government, out of the hands of banks, out of the hands of any individual.
How do we get ready as normal people for the... if there is a catastrophe for this tsunami, what would you invest in?
Well, I mean, personally, I'll hold a lot of gold. I do. My main personal asset is gold. I have to be a bit careful.
You're sitting on a bunch of gold bars right now.
Practically, I'm sitting on a bunch of gold bars right now. Well, no, I have none in my home. I have none in my house. I've stored somewhere else.
For any criminals listening to the Brian Callen Hunter Mock Show,
just sit here. Obviously, I have to be careful. Yes, it comes with my usual disclaimer. I cannot give investment advice, so I don't want everybody to rush out. I can just tell you what I do.
Right.
And although I worked in the financial industry for 20 years, my number one asset, my number one liquid asset is physical gold. I have cash because you never know. I mean, we may have a deflationary shock first. I have a little bit of Bitcoin, but mainly
and a lot of guns, and you're storing water.
I think of obviously any kind of financial catastrophe, and there could be one. And I think if central bankers continue what they've been doing, I think we will at some stage have a major, major reset. That could be ugly. But I'm not necessarily a guns and baked beans kind of guy, for the simple reason that I think we also underestimate how, as you said before, Brian, how quickly people can adapt to situations and cooperate. We don't go back to the Stone Age.
No.
And I think the other thing is, by going back to, as Hunter said before, how do we communicate this to people? I think at the end of the day, we have to realize we need to go back to some kind of form of hard and apolitical money. And if you do that, and the adjustment process will be hard, it's still better than going through some kind of hyperinflationary endgame in which money gets inflated. Hyperinflation or currency collapse is the it's almost as bad as a war. I mean, it is destructive even
yeah,
for sound.
That's right.
It's also.
And I should also say that I'm not helpful when I, you know, the way you change minds is not by criticizing Paul Krugman the way I did with my sarcasm either. I mean, the you've got to get people like Paul Krugman to come over at least a little bit to this side, or at least engage in the debate. And if you do what I do, which is kind of like make fun of him, which is always fun to do, it's not productive. I think
it's
like
cheap
you always
humor,
say, it's
Brian.
Cheap humor, but I'm funny.
Brian, but, it's cheap humor.
It's like dick jokes. It's how I make my living. It's how I like my man. But I do think it's important, as you said, to get the two schools to start talking to each other.
The three schools. I mean, it's worse than two schools.
But
I mean,
we're,
you know.
It's really important. Hunter and I talk about this all the time, man. You get to people. How do you cross that bridge? Because you're right. The converted are talking to each other. And these ideas are too important for that to happen. We've got to figure out a way to break through that sort of.
But even saying we've got to figure out a way, it suggests, oh, at some point in the future, we will address
this
problem.
Well, we're doing it now. We're doing it
now. And that's the point. I think it's not, you don't have to figure out a way. I think it's exactly what Detlev's saying, which is, this is timeless. You know, this is, it is, apolitical, hard money. The power to create money should not be in the hands of politicians. It should not be in the hands of banks. It should not, you know, the whole basis of the Constitution is that you divide power.
Yeah.
You don't put power anyone's person's hands, because absolute power corrupts absolutely. And that's exactly what's happened with money. You know, you've given some people that power and they've abused it.
Yeah. Well, that's why. So let's just talk about the book. It's called Paper Money Collapse: The Folly of Elastic Money, written by Detlev Schlichter, which is a German name. Detlev, what a great name. Yeah. Detlev Schlichter, independent economist, market commentator, and investment strategist. And he's had extensive market experience as a portfolio manager for major institutional investors. I'm reading this, but it sounds like I'm just off the cuff. And he's the author of the award-winning Paper Money Collapse. But it's selling well. You're in your second edition. It's important reading, and it's easy reading, the most important thing. And I really, really appreciate somebody who sits in a dark room or whatever it is and bangs this kind of stuff out, because, you know, your idea and your argument is outside the consensus. It's outside of what is popular. And I think it takes guts to write a book like this. I think it takes guts to stand up on a podium and argue for your point of view, and to then field all the criticism that comes your way from people who haven't read the book, or haven't read the book carefully, or came to your book with preconceived notions, as we all do as human beings. So I really appreciate you coming on the show, Detlev, and I hope you keep doing what you're doing, because I think and I hope you keep shouting from the mountaintop, because I think it's a very important argument, and I think it makes a difference. And I think the way we're going to change the world is through good ideas, not through, you know, guns and stuff.
Guns and baked beans.
And guns, baked beans, and dick jokes. That's not how
exactly.
We're going to change the world.
You may have heard of Guns, Germs, and Steel. Brian is currently working on a book called Guns, Baked Beans, and Dick Jokes.
Yeah, I always say when people come to my show, I go, you're going to laugh your ass off, I promise, for an hour and 15 minutes, but you will learn nothing. and so you're on the other side of the spectrum.
I really appreciate it. It was great to be on the show. Thanks so much.
Well, thanks. You're always welcome back. If you have anything you want to say, or if something's bothering you, come back and talk to us. We're gonna push the book on the website, and I consider it like a privilege, and I give Hunter Motz all the credit for finding guys like you.
Well, listen, I mean, I think that's the thing. Brian and I often talk about, you know, Lawrence Lessig wrote, you know, that everywhere he sees people striking at the branches of evil, but nobody striking at the root.
Yeah, that's actually Thoreau, but yes, he uses that quote.
No, I
in
said,
the book.
But he talks about it,
oh,
which
sorry.
Doesn't imply that he actually said it. Thanks, Brian.
You corrected me, now I'm correcting you, man.
You're trying.
Damn it.
But I think that's the thing. This is really one of those issues. I mean, the case is so compelling that you really do strike at the root of the financial issue. And I think that's so important because, you know, as voters, we have so little time to, you know, wade into the full complexity. But if we can find the root issue, then we can build consensus around it, and then we can fix it.
There you go. Detlev Schlichter. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. If we could see your brain, it'd be just full of muscles, ladies and gentlemen. Hey, take care, man. It's probably late there.
Thank
or
you very much. No, thank you. It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Great stuff. Bye-bye.
Have a great day.
Bye.
Okay. Thanks so much, guys. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. Good guy, man.
Awesome.
Yeah, and a great book. And that was a really... It's I can't, dude. By the way, everybody out there in Canada, I don't know how many people come to me after my show and talk about how awesome Hunter Motz is. All of them just like, dude, Hunter's the real deal. That dude's a genius. That's what I always get. And I always go, he doesn't want to be called a genius. It's against his philosophy. He just knows a lot. So yeah. So thanks to all you guys. I know a lot of people come to my shows, and especially these past 2 weeks in Canada. I just had so many people coming up and saying, hey, tell Hunter he's awesome, and I listen to your show, and it makes me feel so good because there are people out there actually paying attention. I had an immunologist come up to me.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and tell me how much he loved the show and how much he loved you, and it's great. So that's another episode of the Brian Callen Show, the Brian Callen Hunter.
No, just call it Brian. Here's how you get out of it. You just call it the Brian Callen and Friends Show.
I want to call it the Motz Callen Experience.
No.
Conversations with Motz Callen.
Experience is taken. I think actually Joe Rogan copyrighted that word. I don't think you're allowed to use
it. No,
it's
going to be called Conversations with Hunter Motz and Brian Callen. Why is your name first, you son of a bitch? All right, we're out of here. Later. Thanks. Oh, I'm going to be doing stand up
somewhere.
BrianCallen.com.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to BrianCallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.